Hi, you're listening to the New Yorker Poetry Podcast. I'm Kevin Young, poetry editor of the New Yorker magazine. On this program, we invite poets to choose a poem from the New Yorker archives to read and discuss. Then, they read a poem of their own that's been published in the magazine. Today, my guest is the writer Elisa Gonzalez, who was recently a Fulbright Scholar in Poland, and whose work has received support from the Norman Mailer Foundation and the Breadloaf Writers Conference. Welcome, Elisa. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The poem you picked from the archive is Gathering Apricots by Czesław Miłosz. Can you tell us a bit about why this particular poem caught your attention?
I have, as you say, been a Fulbright Scholar in Poland, and so Polish poetry is a particular love and obsession of mine. But this particular Miłosz poem really attracted me because of the kind of revision that happens in the middle, because it comments on the poem that he writes within the context of the poem.
Let's listen to it. Here's Elisa Gonzalez reading Gathering Apricots by Czesław Miłosz, translated from the Polish by the author and Robert Haas.
Gathering Apricots. In the sun, while there, below, over the bay, only clouds of white mist wander fleeting, and the range of hills is grayish on the blue. Apricots, the whole tree full of them, in the dark leaves, glimmer yellow and red, bringing to mind the garden of the Hesperides and apples of paradise. I reach for a fruit and suddenly feel the presence and put aside the basket and say, it's a pity that you died and cannot see these apricots while I celebrate this undeserved life. Commentary. Alas, I did not say what I should have. I submitted fog and chaos to a distillation. That other kingdom of being or non-being is always with me and makes itself heard with thousands of calls, screams, complaints. And she, the one to whom I turned, is perhaps but a leader of a chorus. What happened only once does not stay in words. Countries disappeared and towns and circumstances. Nobody will be able to see her face. And form itself, as always, is a betrayal.
That was Gathering Apricots by Czesław Miłosz, translated from the Polish by the author and Robert Haas, and originally published in the October 29, 1990 issue of the magazine. So this poem struck me, of course, immediately from what you described before we heard it, which is it has this commentary in the middle. In fact, it's half commentary. It's kind of doubles the poem, but it also shadows it. And I'm really interested in the shadow being cast by this beginning, which I would say is kind of almost pastoral and lovely. And then he says, alas, I did not say what I should have. I submitted fog and chaos to a distillation. How do you think this works?
So this book, the book that this is from, is a late book from Miłosz, and it's called Provinces. And he starts to reflect a lot in this book on the other province, as he calls it, or a new province of old age. And so his return to memory, his return to youth, this memory of this woman that he at one point knew, is a melancholy memory for him, I think, very clearly. But the turn, as you say, that shadows it is one that I think puts memory kind of even more in the flow of time, as he says somewhere else about what poetry can do, because he reflects in the moment not just on the memory but on his own gathering of it, like the apricots. In his Nobel lecture, he talks about how a poet has a kind of double vision, that they make a map both distant and concrete. And I think he always had this intense sense of not being able to say what he wanted to say. Mm. And part of that was because he also talks about how the poet, by which he means himself, but he says the poet, always wanted to just contemplate being and beauty.
See.
But because he was caught up in the war and the Holocaust and post-war Poland and went into exile, he had to deal with the loss of friends, the enormous tragedy of the Holocaust, and his survivor's guilt, but also his sense that there was so much that he could not ever capture. And that's, I think, the fog and chaos. And he also talks somewhere else about form as, I think he got this idea from Thomas Mann, but about form as inhuman in some way, as the poet's impulse is an inhuman one, that it's in competition with human solidarity, as he says. And I see that suspicion so much here, like quite, I mean, he comments on it so obviously. And I think that's part of what I find really interesting is, I mean, I think a lot of poets, perhaps you distrust the lyric quite a lot despite working in it.
I understand what you mean. I mean, I think that I was going to ask you about that because this end and form itself, as always, is a betrayal. And of course, that's in translation. But I think what I love about Haas's translations especially are that they're so interesting and invested. And of course, they're collaborative. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder about that suspicion, as you call it. But also, is it memory or poetry that he's distrusting? Because he's also saying, I submitted Fog and Chaos, which is, I think, not just the world, but also one's memory does a process of distillation. And I think you even see that in the beginning, in the sun, while they're below, over the bay, which is, you know, on one hand, really getting more and more specific, and another hand, recasting and refiguring out, or maybe even making up a little bit where this magic moment happened.
Mm-hmm. And the mirroring of the fog and clouds, I think, is a really interesting one. I agree with you that I think he's submitting memory to the same distrust. And also part of that, I think, which you can kind of see the construction of the memory there, is the fact that the verb takes so long to arrive in that first sentence, which takes six lines to finish. But there's so much kind of preamble there as he builds the memory. And yes, it's not a straightforward, wholly trustworthy description, I think, even before you get to the part where he is explicitly criticizing what he did. And the last line is the one that has rung in my head. And I also thought when I first read this of Louise Glick's Celestial Music, A Love of Form is a Love of Endings.
Right.
And the idea that to cast something there is to hold it still, perhaps.
Yeah, to be too neat, perhaps.
Yeah.
But he calls it a betrayal, which is more than just like, it's a little too tidy. It's also, he's saying that the poet who, as you say, is him, is always through the process of making and creating and crafting. And this poem feels very crafted. It's not in a strict form in English, at least, but it has a kind of solid sonnet-like, you know, quality, a sort of thesis, antithesis almost. But it also feels like there are two different forms. One is oddly more fluid and thus kind of less trustworthy in the beginning, and the other one is much more blunt, at least to my ear. Mm-hmm. Countries disappeared in towns and circumstances. I mean, you know, that's just saying a lot of the history that you outlined so well in just, you know, a few lines, in a few words, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody will be able to see her face. You know, and someone else, I think, would end that there. And instead, he takes that extra beat, that extra line. The first stanza is 10 and the second one's 11. And so here he is with this extra moment to indict the very thing that he's doing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that is very true. And I was just thinking about the syntax of the first stanza in relation to the second, because we talked about the delayed verb in the first part, and then in the second part is full of these fairly short, choppy sentences. And those last three lines in particular, countries disappeared in towns and circumstances, nobody will be able to see her face, and form itself, as always, is a betrayal. I mean, Miłosz has a lot of kind of ironic self-absorption, the inability to stay with the memory and the need to bring it back to the reflection on what poetry can do. It is interesting to conceive of it as a neat ending. I mean, to like there are multiple
laments happening. No, I think it's like not neat. I think it's off kilter. I mean, it's odd, quite literally. You know, it's 11 lines. I don't know. It does something to me knowing that it's a little bit lopsided, but doesn't look that at first glance.
Yeah, that's a really good point, which I had not before noticed. And the end becomes a series of propositions, mm-hmm. which are increasingly complicated, I think.
Like, that's right.
And the idea of betrayal obviously invites the question of to whom. I mean, mm-hmm. is it to the subject of the poem who, I was reading this essay by Michał Szymański, who's an archivist in Poland, about this poem. And he says Miłosz is thinking of a real woman. And he returned to this glimpse of her throughout his life in various forms. But it doesn't have to be a specific person.
Sure.
But he certainly is not conjuring that woman for us in any specificity. We would never be able to see her face based on this poem.
But I think that's almost the point. You know, like, what happened only once does not stay in words. That's true, but I've never thought of it that way, which I think is a sign of it being a good poem. It doesn't keep there, but poetry is this kind of effort to keep something that may be fleeting or capture a moment. That's the way that I think the lyric works well, and that I have faith in the lyric because it's aware of its own kind of fleetingness. But I see your point, too, that, you know, do we distrust the ways that it seems like it's fixed or seems like it's immortal in scare quotes, you know? how does that work here? Because he's really writing about time, but he starts off with the apples of paradise, you know, and gives us this kind of big, huge, mythic moment that he then takes apart.
Yeah, and by conjuring the apples of paradise, he's reminding us of, and the reaching for fruit, there's the fall of man and the post-lapsarian world that we suddenly walk into, the undeserved life that maybe we all have. I also don't think, I think Miłosz's distrust of the lyric corresponds with a total faith in it at the same time. I mean,
yeah.
he's a troubled religious soul his whole life, like
sure.
a Catholic who only late in his life could like really come to even say that he believed in God.
Right.
And that tension, I think, is fully felt here, which is something that I really like because certainly the lyric focused on the moment tries to capture it, and we know that it comes from a poet's singular mind. That does make it untrustworthy, but also perhaps the most trustworthy object that one could make. In the sense that you can only represent your own perspective here. The choice that he makes, that the poet makes perhaps every time we write, is not to retreat into silence just because to say anything completely true is impossible.
Right.
And what happened only once does not stay in words is the line that I find the most enigmatic. And form itself as always is a betrayal opens up a lot of questions for me. But what yeah. happened only once does not stay in words is like a series of simple words that did not immediately make sense to me as an idea, really.
Well, it's a leap, and it's referring to a thing that it doesn't quite say, but I also think it encompasses it in such a way that it feels specific. You know, it's like when someone's talking about something and you realize they're describing themselves in an abstract way. It's like, don't you hate it when this thing happens and you're like, that's a story that happened to you, right? Like, there's a way in which that has that kind of quality to me. I had a teacher once talk about the heckler in a poem, and someone like John Berryman, you know, with Mr. Bones, or we can think of any number of other poets who have this kind of commentary or you know, sidekick who interrupts the poem or aren't afraid to take you out of the poem in order to bring you back. And I think that's what's amazing about that commentary, just as a function.
I love that word, the heckler, for this aspect of the poem, although it sounds like Berryman is also more playful than here. What it made me think of is also of like a religious commentary
yes.
on going back. And it's kind of, I just thought of this as, you know, the betrayal is, I think the word heckler also invokes this to some extent. You could find this annoying. You're like, I've just read this first stanza, this very beautiful thing, and then you're telling me
mm-hmm.
it doesn't work at all. So
sure.
why did I go through that?
Right, right. The trauma of a 10-line poem.
Yeah. I mean, yes, obviously it is not that, but there is that sense when poets criticize themselves within
sure.
the text.
Why not make it plain? But the beginning isn't plain to me, and that's one of the things. It's so lush, you know, and it does feel like he's also commenting on, if not romanticism, then some notion of, you know, that you died and cannot see the, you know, there's a kind of, you know, really 19th century almost yearning that is being memorialized. And then he talks about this distillation. But I think one of the modern ways poetry works is it represents the messiness, you know, and it keeps that alive or at our forefront of our minds or even on the page there.
Yes, that is a really good observation about the contrast and the way of updating it, I guess, which we, you know, I could certainly learn from. I mean, I also do love the way that it he traces the progress of a thought in the first part, where it does follow the sort of the way that he comes to this thing. And there is that, I suppose, echo of the Proustian involuntary memory there that's summoned by an object. The beginning is so beautiful, and it was interesting to me. Miłosz is always saying in, like, interviews and stuff that he hates nature. He just goes on and on about this. Like, he lived in Northern California for so long,
sure.
And he's like, it's very beautiful, but it's just not me. Like, I don't – American poets, they love nature. And but he's constantly writing about the natural world, and I think some of it is perhaps that he talks about the world of people being interesting to him.
Right.
And I do wonder if there's something about, like, bringing nature into contact with people, which is interesting. But I also just don't really believe him that he doesn't like
Well,
nature.
I mean, never believe what the poet says about their work. I mean, it's a little like Eliot saying, you know, all poems should be, filled with impersonality. They're an escape from personality. And then, of course, you know, The Wasteland's a very personal poem about a breakdown he had. And, you know, it's often the case that the poet protests too much.
They struggle against the thing, which is actually true. Yeah. And that in itself is another interesting layer to bring. I mean, obviously, like, you don't have to know that to appreciate this poem The Wasteland.
One last question about this poem, which is that you were saying that you read it in Polish. How does it differ for you? I mean, is it still like commentary, or does it have a different feel, or...
I am not fluent in Polish enough to read poetry with any kind of... without extreme difficulty. But it is commentary, which is part of the reason I went to look for it, because I was curious about the translation. I mean, Miłosz spoke English well, and Haas is obviously a wonderful, wonderful translator. So I didn't distrust the translation, but I was just curious for myself.
The choices.
Yeah, I did want to know. And I mean, and I find the poet who I was studying most when I was in Poland was Zbigniew Herbert. And his, unlike Miłosz, he uses very little punctuation, if any, and his syntax is often more obviously complicated, at least. And I was curious because I had felt like when thinking about Herbert's poetry, Polish, because of the fact that it is a case-based language and the nouns change to reflect the grammatical function that they have in the sentence, the syntax is so much more flexible because it doesn't have to be subject, verb, object in some form. And I was wondering if, like, Miłosz was playing with anything like that. It wasn't as – I mean, the beginning was complicated, but the end was not.
I think that is so illuminating what you just said about it. I'm curious about that, how that translates – in the poem, because to me, what you're describing is what he's done, both Haas and Miłosz, in their translation, which starts out fluid, as I said, and then is kind of punchy at the end. So there's this kind of evocation of, at least, of a kind of grammar or syntax of change.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I could not pretend to truly judge the translation, but it did seem to me to really reflect the poem. Although the only thing is that the last line in Polish, which I unfortunately cannot quote from memory, does have internal rhyme in it that is definitely, like, it's so much choppier and harsher in English. And I just thought that was interesting. But Polish is a more flowing language anyway. Like, people are always like, it's like over and over again. So there's that. But it is interesting.
Beautiful. Now, in the November 4th, 2019 issue of the magazine, The New Yorker published your poem, Failed Essay on Privilege, which we'll hear you read momentarily. Is there anything you'd like to say about the poem beforehand? Anything our listeners might need or want to know?
I think it's fairly self-explanatory, so I will just go ahead and read the poem.
All right. Here's Alisa Gonzalez reading her poem, Failed Essay on Privilege.
Failed Essay on Privilege. I came from something popularly known as nothing, and in the coming, I got a lot. My parents didn't speak money, didn't speak college. Still, I went to Yale. For a while, I tried to condemn. I wrote, "Let me introduce you to evil." Still, I was a guest there. I made myself at home. And I know a fine shoe when I see one, and I know to be sincerely sorry for those people's problems. I know to want nothing more than it would be so nice to have, and I confess I'll never hate what I've been given as much as I wish I could. Still, I thought I of all people understood Aristotle, what is and isn't the good life, because, I wrote, privilege is an aggressive form of amnesia. I left a house with no heat. I left the habit of hunger. I left a room I shared with 7 brothers and sisters I also left. Even the good is regrettable, or at least sometimes should be regretted. Yet to hate myself is not to absolve her. I paid so much for wisdom, and look at all of this. Look at all I have.
That was Failed Essay on Privilege by Elisa Gonzalez.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
I love hearing that poem and hearing you read it. I was waiting to hear how you were going to read the ending with a dash. It ends with a dash. Obviously, that's a sort of continuity, is there more after the dash? And I love that kind of question. I also thought when you were reading it that there is a kind of commentary in this poem. If not, it's a poem that's commenting on a way of being. And even previous writing, I wrote, privilege is an aggressive form of amnesia. Were you thinking about that sort of self-conscious quality?
Yeah, yes. And that was another reason I was attracted to the Mielisch poem, because I thought, I understand this impulse. I was struggling to write poems. I wrote this while I was in Poland. And I was decided to give myself, prompts. It was like, write a poem as if it is an essay on a subject, but don't necessarily write an essayistic poem.
Sure.
And I tried to write about this so many times because this is accurately autobiographical. I did go to Yale. I did grow up in poverty, and I do have 7 brothers and sisters. So the facts are basically there. But I had always struggled to write about it because my life has moved, right? And it always felt hypocritical to either try to evoke to evoke the past as if I were innocent of any of the things that I disliked when I got to this space of immense privilege.
Sure, yeah.
And then I was trying to, the failed reflects a sense that it always would have to end in a dash because I can never actually finish the thought or something. Mm. And also my sense of trouble that I have about writing about my family, because it does feel like taking other people's lives and then holding them up to say, look at this, see how it relates to me. So they become very small within the context of the poem and fairly undefined relative to some of the other things, the thinking I think about them. But yeah, it was very much a reckoning of trying to think and trying to write something that was ethical as well as honest, I suppose.
Well, those are two good concerns, I think. I love so many lines in the poem. I left a house with no heat, period. I left the habit of hunger, period. I left a room, break. I mean, that's really, I think, one of the hearts, because I think it has many shifting tones, which I also appreciate. But it has that bluntness we were talking about with Miłosz, but it also has a kind of roominess at the end. I left a room. You know, my parents were the first in their families to go to college, and they went all the way. I mean, my dad ended up going to med school. My mom got a PhD in chemistry, you know. And they grew up in the segregated South, where none of these things were not only expected, they were actively trying to be prevented. And so, you know, I feel in this poem that kind of, it's not just guilt, it's kind of a doubt or a questioning. It's survivor's guilt in some way, like you were talking about with Milos. But I also am interested in this line, even the good is regrettable, or at least sometimes, break, should be regretted, break. Yet to hate myself is not to absolve her. And that her is really great. Does her need absolving?
Yeah, I think so. That is a complicated sentence that has took me a lot of wrestling with. I mean, I think the idea of the good is regrettable is does emerge from the poem in a more organic way, in the sense that it, you know, what can be regretted is the distance that has now emerged between the past and the present self. And I often would end up, when trying to write about this in different forms, I guess because the sense of doubled existence has been such a feature of my life, with a kind of self-indictment or self-hatred, like, you are the betrayer. Mm. But that felt too lazy.
Yeah.
That there's no, like, okay, fine. Like, you think you did a bad thing by doing a good thing. Like, you feel guilty about some aspect of your life. Like, lots of people do. There's nothing there.
And, you know, nothing to sneeze at, this achievement that is being wrestled over.
It's funny. I've gotten a fair number of emails from people about this poem, which it was interesting to me. Variety of ones. One from a woman who's in the first co-ed class at Yale, actually. But I got a packet of essays from a high school class.
Nice.
And I looked at some of them, and a lot of them called the speaker pretentious and unlikable.
Oh, wow.
But I thought that there is something there about the kind of ironic distance that is perhaps not coming through, but that does also take effect in that line, yet to hate myself is not to absolve her, which is to push the person, the subject of the poem, who's also the writer, away enough to, like, try to grapple with her.
Yeah, I mean, I take the end as somewhat ironic. I mean, it must be. Look at all I have. You know, if you say it many more times, you start to doubt it, right? I paid so much for wisdom, and look at all of this. Look at all I have. And what the speaker has is a dash, really, or what comes after.
Yes.
And even the essay has failed, because the poem has indicated that this is the way that it must be in this moment. And I'm also interested in a word that I think is one of these great words that I know I turn to sometimes. It's still. And you say, still, dash, I went to Yale. Or still, comma, I was a guest there. I made myself at home. And these two things, of course, are traditionally thought of as opposites, a guest and home. There's a kind of switch even in that line.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was very interested. I mean, the still, I was a guest. I did kind of envision the poem as kind of a zigzaggy shape, mm-hmm. that it, like, can't remain stable for too long, which is also partly something that Louise Glick was a teacher of mine, and she's always so focused on surprise, like, and when the poem becomes plodding, as she says, all these things. So I constantly felt myself falling into something which was just, you know, tendentious or plodding. So I was like, no, you have to go somewhere else. And the word still was a kind of anchor, which was allowing me to provide some kind of doubt and contrast at the same time. And that I was a guest there, I made myself at home. I was thinking about how people do often say, make yourself at home when you're a guest. Sure. I'm like, of course you can't do that. Like, it's so uncomfortable to be a guest. But to imagine, like, walking into a space that doesn't belong to you, and then to some extent, like, occupying it, was something that I wanted to play with.
I think also, to me, it calls in to mind, why can you not belong there? You know, that's, I think, lurking behind the poem. It's like, you must feel this way when, you know, not everyone feels that way going to college. They might think, I deserve this, you know, or this is all great, which perhaps is privilege, but it's also a shame that the speaker can't, I don't know, feel at home sometimes. At least sometimes I yearn that. Mm. Yearn to hear the humor of, still, I thought I, of all people, understood Aristotle, what is and isn't the good life, which you italicize.
Yeah. I mean, there is, I guess, that question, which is like, do you have to be born in the house to be at home there? But it's not just about privilege. It is also about the particular person and the interaction with the space. Like the experience is not one size fits all there. And I do, like, I personally like that Aristotle line because I also see like a childish arrogance there, which is like you also arrive as an outsider and you're like, you don't understand this world because you're too inside it and I get it. Like you don't know. Yeah. And one line that I think is also funny is like, I don't actually think privilege is an aggressive form of amnesia. There is also irony. I mean, I don't know what it is. Like, I couldn't possibly define it.
Isn't that like an old self? Like first year of college. That's what I took those as.
Yes, that's exactly right. But it does have, again, that error, I think, of like, I understand this now. And I think where the poem ends up being is like, I don't understand a lot of things.
Well, and I again, keep thinking about that sort of turning that happens where you say in the first line, I came from something popularly known as nothing. And even in that, you have this kind of doubling, as you were talking about, that I love. I wondered a broader question or two. One is that I wonder how people write about autobiography and how you think about autobiography in a poem. And, you know, I think I struggled early on writing about things that were me but weren't me. I mean, often it was about my family, so it felt like I was like translating these ghosts and getting them down and trying to see them in poetry, which I hadn't seen before.
I like that phrase, translating ghosts. I think that feels quite accurate. Yes, I continued to struggle with autobiographical writing despite the fact that I think about myself all the time, as many poets perhaps do. I started writing poetry when I got to college, and my first poetry workshop was a tremendous like explosion for me because there were all these things that I had never said or perhaps imagined saying before, and suddenly it was all my my family, my feelings about things that I had never articulated to myself. But I also, I think as I grew older, just became more suspicious of the truth of those impressions, or felt that I was perhaps too close to things to be able to see it. So maybe I was straining for the distance that Miłosz talks about. But we have in poetry like immense and limited material, I guess. So I do feel that autobiography is, I mean, I'm trying to return to it now to figure out like what are the ways that one can approach this to kind of properly translate life or ghosts into something on the page. So maybe this is the kind of clearing of something, like a fear or a preemptive admission of failure that one can then go on to work from. Miłosz says, perhaps in his Nobel lecture again, like, perhaps every memory is a memory of a wound. And I do think that I like the perhaps because it's not so definitive, but
he gets away with it. With simple perhaps.
The perhaps is really such a good word, but I do think of that, which is like not so much that you know every memory is a trauma, but that to go back into memory is difficult.
Yeah. Well, I wondered also just if the distance of being in Poland helped you write about these kind of domestic in the largest sense questions, these questions of home.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I mean, there is something like as soon as I got to Poland, which was in 2016, the U.S. started to feel immensely far away, like everything felt far away. And there there was a sense in which I was suddenly in a world that no one I knew anything about.
Right.
There was a tremendous amount of, I felt, translating of myself into a new context that was mm-hmm. happening, a new language, which is like impossible because you can never say anything for so long. It's so frustrating. But yes, going back to memories, I thought I would write a lot more about Poland when I was in Poland, and I didn't.
No, that's really hard.
Yeah, there was no distance there. So that does seem essential to it. And also, you may just become obsessed with the things that you don't have at that
sure.
moment. The absence produces some sort of space for whatever your poetic imagination happens to consist of.
Yeah, I think it's hard to write about what's right in front of you. I think it comes up, too, now about the times we're in, where people are trying to write about it, but it's hard to know. And sometimes people who are writing about it, who don't think they're writing about it, are writing about it the most, you know? The switch into being conscious of that is, I think, really important and part of a poet's job, especially now, I think, to think about how can I write something that lasts but also may be relevant, you know? And I feel this is very true with both the poems we've looked at, and especially yours, thinking about wrestling with these kinds of questions of regret and wisdom and having and belonging and owning. These are the things that I think, you know, flit through the paper but aren't said so clearly or so powerfully.
Yeah. It is very hard. And as you say, there's been a lot of discussion about how to write about what's happening. And I think to some extent, although I'm on social media, it does make it harder because there's a constant quick turn translation of everything into meaning, to naming it, to interpreting it. Whereas as a poet, I just feel that I need a little more time.
Like 6 years
Something.
Year long residency.
But I guess there's the possibility of approaching things at an angle, which I think is a mm-hmm. poet's like tremendous power. Because Miłosz does write directly about historical events. Some of his most famous poems, like Campo de Fiori and A Poor Christian Looks at the Ghetto, Dedication, they're addressed this. And in this poem, you know, countries disappeared and towns and circumstances. Circumstances is a word I love there. But so he's not like not addressing it, but he also doesn't he's never like just describing it or saying that it's bad, you know,
yeah.
Like that's not what he's choosing to do. And I guess like what I would aspire to is to find the sideways way into it.
Tell the truth, but tell it slant.
Yeah. Well, you know, someone already said it better.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I heard that somewhere.
Yeah.
Well, I think you've done that. And I really appreciate you talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Failed Essay on Privilege by Elisa Gonzalez, as well as Czesław Miłosz's Gathering Apricots, can be found on NewYorker.com.
You may subscribe to this podcast, the Fiction Podcast, the Writer's Voice Podcast, and the Politics and More Podcast by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can hear more poetry read by the authors on NewYorker.com and the New Yorker app, available from the App Store or from Google Play. The theme music is The Corner by Christian Scott Atunde Ajua, courtesy of Stretch Music and Rope-A-Dope. The New Yorker Poetry Podcast is produced by Michelle Moses, with help from Hannah Eisenman.